Welcome back to the Mojo Podcast. We're here every fortnight with revealing and ultimately positive stories of overcoming adversity, surviving, winning against the odds, and embracing change. A place to find inspiration and rediscover your mojo. We've had many stories of incredible resilience in the face of adversity, just as Skylar Thompson shared in the last episode when talking about losing his mother, aged just six. This week's story is no different. From a traumatic experience to almost dazzling human endeavour. Our journey starts in the far north of Scotland, then we move to war-torn Afghanistan, before taking us to the searing heat of the Saharan Desert in southern Morocco.
I remember just thinking, right, this is day one. We're on day one now. We're on day one. I'm here. Now we can start doing some stuff. I think that's when I decided that I needed challenges. I needed stuff to aim for. You know, I need to give myself something. And that's when all this sort of stuff started to happen. That's when I started putting in for things and started to push on.
This week, I talked to Duncan Slater, former Royal Air Force infantry soldier, and we talk about his journey of injury, recovery, and incredible sporting achievement. Duncan talks very candidly about the incident in Afghanistan which left him critically injured after his patrol was hit by an IED. We talk about the choice Duncan faced, whether to keep his injured legs or to have them amputated. And then the choice on how to be from that point, as he calls it, day one. Day one as a double amputee, and day one of what he wanted to do next. For himself, for his identity, and for others, via fundraising for the military charity Walking with the Wounded, for example. Having cycled Land's End to John O'Groats just months after losing his legs, and then walked to the South Pole with Prince Harry, and completed the London Marathon, Duncan still wanted to do more, to push himself further, raise more money and awareness, to ultimately answer the question, what am I capable of now? The second half of our chat is the story of how Duncan took on and eventually completed the toughest foot race on the planet, without feet. He became the first double amputee to complete the fabled Marathon des Sables in 2017. Often referred to as the Everest for runners, covering six marathons in 6 days, just swap ice and cold for sand and heat. It's an equally inhospitable environment for us humans. As you'll hear, the challenge was far from straightforward. There was pain, failure, learning, incredible kindness from strangers, and just the most incredible levels of determination. Determination to prove just what he was capable of, to himself and to others who had doubted his ability. There's no boasting here, just a guy full of humility who found a new confidence that he could achieve the seemingly impossible. The sort of belief that is a massive source of mojo. It's seriously inspiring stuff. I hope you really, really enjoy this conversation. If you do, as I always say, please do subscribe to the podcast for a notification on the next episode. Please do leave a 5-star rating. And above all, could you please take some time to write a short review on Apple Podcasts? Okay, this is an amazing story, so let's get straight into it. Here's my conversation with Duncan Slater. So welcome back to the Mojo Podcast. I'm delighted to have with me today Duncan Slater, all the way from Norfolk in the UK. Duncan, how are you doing today?
Yeah, really good. Thank you, mate. Thanks for having me.
Hi, it's a pleasure. And so I always start this way. How's the mojo today? How is it out of 10? What would you give yourself?
I think in these times, mate, I'll go for a solid 7 at the minute. I think that's probably safe ground at the minute.
Yeah, exactly. We're recording right at the end of January 2021. As you say, in these times, 7 probably seems like a pretty good score. Maybe 7 today is the old 9.
Yeah, I reckon it's sort of jaded a little bit, but it's still good. You know, it's you got to take the little wins, haven't you? And just sort of try and keep perspective. So, do you know what, mate? All things considered, doing fine. You know, so I think, like most people, if the family's all right, you're sort of all right. You know, pretty good. The wife's all right. Little ones in homeschooling. which is kind of frustrating her, but she's still all right. We're all safe and healthy, so I'll take that any day of the week, mate.
Yeah. And you know what? You use that word perspective there. And I think there's something, because obviously we're going to talk about your military background in a bit. And I had a conversation in my first series with a guy called Louis Nethercott, who was in the Marines. And he suffered from PTSD. Now he's on a massive expedition to walk the world's five biggest islands. And he used that word perspective a lot in exactly that sort of context about, you know what, when I think about other things I've done, other parts of the world and challenges that are going on, as you say, it's okay. We're okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I think we do that, don't we? I think you have to look at the sort of everyone, but you can look at the bad times, look at where you are now and think, yeah, it's all right. It's fine. You know, I mean, I know it's frustrating for people. And I think, you know, without being political, with the media, you either get something really positive or really negative. You never get in the middle where the vast majority of us are that go, yeah, it's all right. It's just a bit boring, really. Yeah. And I think what it does is it kind of plays on the senses a little bit. And I think when you turn that off, when you sort of go, right, hang on a minute, what about my reality? Well, how am I doing here? And you sort of think, it's all right. It's okay. We're doing all right.
Yeah. And as you say, you know, there are things that you've been through in your own personal life, which we'll come to talk about, which probably help with that sense of, you know what, all things considered, I'm okay. And when I say that, and you mark yourself very clearly, that's 7 out of 10, how your mojo is. What does mojo mean to you, Duncan?
I think it's a few things, mate. I think if it was like a mixing bowl, you'd add in your mojo mixing bowl, I think you'd add in there morale, wouldn't you? Your well-being, a sort of cup full of motivation, a little bit of drive. And I think it's all of those things, really. So I think if you said to me, how's your mojo and what is it today? I think for me, it's like, where are you? How are you? And are you doing all right? You know, and everything interconnected with all that, really. I think maybe, you know, for me, I know everyone's different, but I think it's my family daily bubble. You know, how is that going? And I think if everyone's in sort of all right spirits, that's okay. You know, I mean, at the minute, I think if you can maintain some sort of routine that's doable, you know, I think the danger is that you stray onto social media and you've got people that are doing, you know, a marathon in the garden, and then you've got people that are doing one gazillion press-ups for 30 days solid in January and stuff. You've got that, and then you sort of gauge yourself against that and you're going, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing anything like that. I'm just trying to keep everyone happy in the house. I'm trying to make sure that the old couple down the road are isolating and they've got a bit of shopping. You know, that's my reality. So I try to stay off things that I know are just not achievable. And I just try and kind of maintain my own little world, really, mate. And that's my mojo, you know, that's my little recipe, I suppose.
Well, I love that cooking analogy of the mixing bowl. Is that a hobby, a pastime, cooking?
Oh, yeah, love a bit of cooking, mate. Yeah, love it. A bit of baking. Yeah, can't go wrong. My mum was a, you know, she's a big sort of baker. Yeah. And the same. And, you know, it's great to do with if you're just bored and you're like, right, come on, we'll get the pots and pans out and just make something. And you just get the little one in the kitchen, mate, and make a mess. And at the end of it, you got something. I think it's not a bad way to do it, is it, really?
Exactly. But I love that metaphor of all these things, these ingredients that go in to make your mojo, as you say, your morale, well-being, motivation, drive. And what I took a lot, actually, from what you were saying, as long as my family's okay. And then you referenced the old people down the road, which you're obviously looking out for as well. So there's a sense for me that your mojo might be linked to how other people around you are doing. Is that true?
Yeah, I'd go with that, mate. Yeah, I mean, please don't think that I'm the most sort of selfless person on the planet, but I think like now you tend to come into people's lives, if that makes sense, and sort of chance meetings along the way and stuff. And I met a guy, an old fella, about 3 years ago now, and he was just sat in a cafe on his own, and he had the same sort of enamel little military badge on that I used to wear when I was in the military. I thought that's a bit weird because he's really old. And I was like, hey, you're right, buddy. What's that badge? And he says, oh, I was in such and such. And I went, oh, no way, I was in that. And it turned out he was 85 at the time when we met. And we now are just like best mates. So he'd lost his wife a few months before we met. Lives on his own. His son is out in the States, which he obviously keeps in touch with. So he's in our little bubble now. And he's mega. He's 88, he's 89 this year. And he's a legend. He's great, you know. And for me, he has been probably one of the best things about lockdown. He gives you like a real sense of purpose. You know, he can't go out and do stuff like his shopping and stuff like that. It's not safe. So you go, right, I'll do that. And it just, I don't know, it's a bit of an escape for you. You know, you've got something else to concentrate on, and I think that's a good thing. So he's been very, you know, as much as I've probably helped him, he has helped me without him realizing it, you know, and that's a good thing.
I was going to say, isn't that beauty in that relationship is it's completely two-way. Someone from the outside might be looking, oh, Duncan's doing a nice thing, you know, helping out this old guy. Yeah. Actually, he's really helping you with that, of purpose and probably more perspective as well.
Yeah.
So you mentioned obviously what, you know, you noticed this guy because of the military badge that he was wearing. Let's talk about your time in the military, which will bring us up to, you know, part of why we're talking and some of the amazing things that you have done. But tell me a bit about your time in the military.
Okay, so I joined up in 1998, so I just turned 19, so quite young. Really. And I was desperate to join the military. I'm from the very north of Scotland, up the other side of Inverness. And for me, I really craved a sort of just an adventure. That's what took me to Afghanistan in 2009,
yeah,
where I was unfortunately injured. I was working with the Afghan military at the time. And we were mentoring. So typically what would happen is, as a sergeant, I would be working alongside another Afghan sergeant. And you would just show them how you do things, you know, planning and administration. And then you go out on the ground and you'd actually do it, you know, like for real. And the idea was that at some point, as it is now, you're going to hand the Afghan back to the majority of the Afghan military forces. So they need to be competent and be able to stand on their own two feet. So that was the idea behind it. And, you know, it was a good job. I liked it. You know, you lived day and night with the Afghan military. And I liked it. You know, I think if you're going to go to these countries and going to go and do these things, you know, you don't want ever to be like Britain. You know, you can't, it's not like the days of old, like in a big campaign where you turn up and it's like little England. You know, it's right. You go to these places now, you go to Iraq and Afghan, you have to ingratiate yourself with their military and respect the way they do things. And I like that. You know, you got to know them, you got to live with them and sort of learn all about them. And it was interesting, mate. It was an eye opener. But unfortunately, you know, where we're working, the things that we're doing, there is a real risk. And the biggest sort of risk at the time were the roadside bombs, the IEDs, you know, things that are planted in the ground that you step on or you drive over, they detonate and it causes a lot of injuries and obviously deaths as well. So long story short, mate, we were patrolling down a road in our vehicles and my vehicle was blown up by a roadside bomb. So there was a crew of three people on our vehicle and everyone was fine. Everyone survived. But the bomb went off directly underneath me. So where I was sitting was like just in the passenger side of a vehicle, you know, like the passenger side of your car, if you like.
Yeah.
And because the bomb went off directly underneath me, the sort of, the forces, the physics and all the rest of it, the blast, I got the sort of main shock of the blast, and it completely disintegrated my legs. You know, it was really, really badly broken. Threw me out of the vehicle, and the impact of landing and the blast, it fractured my lower spine, broke my arm quite badly, shoulder blade, ribs, all the sort of injuries that you'd associate with sort of getting blown up, you know, sort of trauma. But you know, as it was back then, and I suppose it's a terrible thing, but it's a good thing that the sort of path to sort of, you know, the medical route, if you like, the Casivac route, was so well oiled. It was a slick machine. You know, you get injured and it's straight back to Camp Bastion. No messing about, you know, 20 minutes and you're on a helicopter. And then I was subsequently put back to Birmingham, into the military ward there. And that's where I stayed for 5 months in total. I was in a bit of a state. So I was, yeah. I was there for quite a long time.
Wow. Can you remember the moment of the explosion?
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah. So sometimes what happens in these situations is, people kind of mix reality with sort of, you know, their body's way of coping. So it becomes like some sort of, you know, organic, great, fantastic story. But I can tell you as clear as a bell what happened. And as we were driving down the road, I stopped our convoy. So you get on the radio and you say, stop, stop, stop. And everything stopped. And I says, right, everyone, put your belts on. Now in the vehicles, you can imagine you're getting in and out of these vehicles all the time. You've got a lot of kit and equipment on. They come with like mandatory like seat harness things. There's no way you're ever going to wear these things. It's like, come on, never going to happen. But what they did have was like a little, it was like a bit of a token effort, really, a little belt that went over your lap. And it was just to stop, if the vehicle fell over, to stop you rolling out of the vehicle. And it says, like, everyone put your lap belts on. I've just got a really bad feeling. And then we were like, right, go, move forward. We moved forward about 10 or 15 feet and then bang, my vehicle got blown up. Now, this genuinely, if I hadn't had that belt on with the blast, it would have, you know, it would have been catastrophic. So the seat ended up taking the majority of the blast, not me. So therefore, that little lap belt thing saved my life.
So you had some kind of sense, and obviously this is your training as well as intuition. You just thought, you know what? Something's not right.
I had a horrible... So me and my best friend, which I'll tell you all about him later on, but
yeah,
we woke up that morning, and the routine was that you'd wake up in a compound somewhere, horrible, disgusting compounds, and the only little slice of morale that you could have, or mojo, if you like, was have a little coffee, right? Have a little rationed coffee. And we'd sit there in the morning, have a brew, have 5 minutes just to get your head straight. And I said to him, I says, mate, I don't feel good this morning. Something's not right. I've got a real bad feeling. And he said, you know, I've got a bad feeling too. And we both had this horrible feeling in the pit of our stomachs. And as we left this compound in our vehicles, I turned around to him and I said, mate, I think it's me. I think it's me today. And the weird thing was, he turned around and he goes, yeah, I know what you mean. I know what you mean. And about 20 minutes later, the explosion happened. It was a huge relief when I was injured, because we were out in the ground with about 30 British troops, you know, my platoon, there's about 30 guys. And then there was about 50-ish Afghans. And I really think if had it been one of those guys, you know, had it been one of my blokes, I don't think I'd have taken it very well. You know, we'd lost guys up until that point, that was about 3 months into the tour. We'd lost guys up to that point, and it's traumatic to lose. It's quite cold saying colleagues, but you don't know everyone, but you kind of know them, but they're not all great friends, you know. But it's traumatic because you're there at the source, at the point of injury, and it's not ideal. And I just had enough of that, you know. I was just like, I can't, you know. And I was waiting for it to be one of my friends, one of my blokes. And when it happened to me, it's weird how your brain works. My brain sort of thought, well, I've soaked one up. I've used up an IED. And like, that's one less IED for the blokes to trigger. And I know that sounds ridiculous, but in my mind, that was the easiest way to sort of swallow it. And it was like, well, I've soaked one up for the boys there, so that's one less for them to hit.
Wow.
I know it doesn't work like that, but
well, but so, but you did that feeling then, as you said the word relief, and we'll fast forward, you're in hospital in Birmingham, as you say, for 5 months, and then the rehab afterwards. Did that help you with your own rehabilitation, do you think?
Yeah, it did. So a couple days, sorry, 6 days after I was injured, when I was in hospital, word came to the hospital that unfortunately, on another platoon, two guys were killed. And I was like, oh no, like I can't keep lying in hospital waiting for these things to come in, this information to come in. And sort of luckily, or just the way things went, nothing really happened after that. But I think, yeah, to answer your question, I think you've got a lot of time on your hands in hospital and in all these places in rehab. You've got so much time to think, and sometimes it can be a real, it can be a bad thing, because you can, depending on your mental state, you can dwell on the negatives. And I, if I'm honest, I'd had enough of thinking like that in hospital. I'd just had enough of it. So when I got to rehabilitation, I thought, I'm not thinking like that anymore. I've had enough of it. You know, I need to get something good out of every day moving forward. And that's what I'm going to do now. And honestly, even if it was something ridiculous, you know, it was almost like going back to being a kid again, and sort of thinking as simply as you could, and just think, well, you know, all right, I haven't gained anything today, but you know, what have I done? Well, I managed to, like, you know, I don't know, I managed to get inside the swimming pool, paddle water for 5 minutes and get out. Brilliant. Well, I couldn't have done that 2 weeks ago, you know. And it was something as mundane and as silly as that. And it just meant that I felt I was somehow winning or achieving or somehow in control. You know, ultimately your body's in control, you know, how it copes, how it heals up. And I was losing that overall. So after about a year in hospital, in rehabilitation, I was in a lot of pain with my legs.
Yeah.
And they said, look, something's not right here. We need to get you for some tests. I went for some tests, went to see a specialist, and he said, look, mate, your legs are not in a good way. The bones are starting to die. Because to sort of explain it, when I was blown up, when the blast went off, my feet came into contact with the floor of the vehicle, like very quickly, and sort of, it's called deck slap. So they smash your legs. So as opposed to like breaking legs where you can see the breakage, if you went sort of halfway down my shin bone, everything was like, it was like a crunchy bar had been all smashed up. So the poor doctors, you know, how do you even start piecing all that stuff back together? You know, they tried putting metalwork in, wire, all this different stuff. And they were like, look, they kind of look like feet. They didn't, but they're like, they kind of look like feet, but we don't think you're going to be able to walk on them. You know, we don't know what's going to happen. And so, yeah, long story short, the specialist was like, look, two choices, mate. You can stay as you are, or you can go for amputations. And because I'd been at Headley Court in rehab for a year, I'd seen all these amputees running around doing stuff. And I was thinking, well, I've kept my legs. I've kept all the bits, you know, that, which is good, but I can't use them. It's pointless. You know, it's I'm not using it. I'm not up and about. I'm not doing things. I'm not being active. And my daughter had been born at this point, so she's only a few months old. And, you know, I'm literally taking medication like it's going out of fashion for the pain, and it just wasn't good, mate.
So you made that decision then to, I mean, I say the doctor offered you two choices, but you were pretty clear about the choice that you were going to take.
I actually said to him, I said, look, if I was your son, what would you recommend? And I think I kind of derailed him a bit, because
wow,
he was like, oh,
what a question.
He was like, well, yeah, he was like, no one's asked me that before. I was like, well, but what would you say? And he was like, I'll go for the amputations. And I was like, well, there you go then. I was like, sign me up. And yeah, 6 weeks later, I'd had the amputations. And, you know, even on the days where you sort of think life's not good, I have never, ever regretted that decision, ever. I mean, it was the best decision I've ever made. 100% the right choice for me. And I've never ever regretted it. It was the right way to go.
Yeah. So after that decision and obviously the operation, how long did it take before you were able to actually, as you said, you know, the problem you had is that you had pre the amputation, you had legs, but you couldn't do anything. When could you actually start doing things and moving again, which is obviously something that's so important to you?
So what they like to do is after the operation, you know, you get a little couple of weeks sort of to get over the amputations and let things heal up. But then they like to get you up. They like to get you on a set of legs and get you up as soon as they can, because it helps with everything from the sort of healing, the swelling, and all the rest of it. So it was a couple of weeks. I mean, it was a short amount of time. It was definitely under a month. And I was stood up on a pair of legs for the very first time since I've been injured. You know, I'd been confined to a wheelchair all that time. And that was just the most amazing feeling, to stand up, not be in any pain. And I remember it, mate. I've got a photograph of it, but I remember just thinking, right, this is day one. We're on day one now. We're on day one. I'm here. Now we can start doing some stuff. And I think that's when I decided that I needed challenges. I needed stuff to aim for. You know, I need to give myself something.
Yes.
And that's when all this sort of stuff started to happen. You know, that's when I started putting in for things and started to push on, because I wanted to know, like, what am I capable of now? You know, I can swallow the whole getting injured thing. It's not a problem. It's not really a massive stumbling block, but it's about now. You know, how am I right now? Like, what can I do? Can I do X, Y, and Z? And what's the point of it? Can I better other people's, you know, lives for it? So can I raise money? Can I help people? Can I do things? And that's when I started to reevaluate everything. And that was how I started.
Yeah. So that's where I wanted to sort of put you now, is the Marathon de Sable, the toughest foot race on the planet, 6 marathons in 6 days across the South Moroccan desert. So you arrived there at the start line in 2016. Why did you decide to take that on, Duncan?
Yeah, good point. So myself and a friend, we'd done the London Marathon together, and we, on the way around it, we said, well, we should do a real adventure together. We should do something. And we approached Ed Parker, who's the CEO, and we said, look, any chance we could get a space? And he says, yeah, okay, yeah, all right. You can have a space. And so we trained as best as we could. Now, no double leg amputee had done this before.
And this is key, isn't it? This is the important point here. No one had done this quite in your position.
No. And so when we approached the race organizers to begin with, they were like, no way. You can't have a space. It's not, no way. It's too dodgy. And I can understand that from a visual perspective of it might look different because you're missing two legs. I understand that. But really, the risks are the same. So we trained, as like I said, as best as we could. But I didn't have, there was no one there to say, mate, just think about this as a double amputee. Think about that. Think about the next thing. There was nothing.
Right.
And there are considerations, you know, not less or more than anyone else. It's just different, that's all. So we went into 2016, sort of flying blind in a sense. I'd got as fit as I could. Kit and equipment was as good as it could be. Nutrition and all the rest of it. Prosthetics-wise for me, the legs were all right, but they weren't great, and I didn't know what walking on the sand for 156 miles was going to do. I didn't know, and sometimes you've just got to go for it and see. So we did the first three marathons, and then you come to day four, and that's a double marathon. That's 56 miles, and it was on that one. We were coming up a big sand dune, a big jebel. It's like a sand-covered hill. It's fairly significant. And I just felt this horrible rubbing feeling on the front of my shin bones, and it was the prosthetics were rubbing. So you add sand, sweat, heat, you know, your hydration's up and down, so that has an effect. I got to the top of this sand dune, and I sat down, and there was blood coming out the top of my prosthetic liners. Now, I didn't tell my mate. We're about 10 kilometers in, and I didn't want to tell him because he's my best mate. I don't want him to know that I'm sort of suffering. So I just kind of, it's not a good thing, and it's not something I'd recommend to anyone, but I just kind of gripped my teeth and got on with it. I never took the liners off because I knew I wouldn't get them back on.
Wow.
And we just kept going. So we walked for 30-odd hours. We did the distance. We crossed over the line, and I sort of turned to him and I said, look, mate, I need to go and see the medics. And we went to see the medics. And as they pulled my sort of silicone liners off, unfortunately, a lot of the shin bone started to sort of peel off with it. So they started to deglove, basically. And these French medics were like, we don't know how to fix you. And now they're talking in French. And there was this lady from the charity there that was interpreting. And this poor guy stood at the end of the bed, and he was just like, I don't know how to fix you. And I said to her, because I knew her quite well, I said, oh, tell him there's no way he can make them grow back, if that's what he means. And she turned around and she was like, I'm not saying that, that's not funny. You shoot me. And I was just like, oh, come on. And she was like, it's not funny, Duncan, this isn't the time. And I was like, oh, okay. And but I mean, I suppose the reality kind of hit home, right? That I was like, right, I've got one more marathon to do. It's only one more marathon to do. I've done five. But looking down, there was no way. I mean, even if they dressed them up and taped them up, and you couldn't physically put weight on them.
Yeah.
And that, for me, was the biggest kicker, was of making it sound grand by saying all the things I've done, but on everything I've done, I've never had to quit on anything. And this is the first time. And the only way you can get out of this is by basically saying that you want to quit. And you've got to fill in the back of your race number and hand it in saying, I want to come off the race. And I had to do that. And I felt just awful, like a failure, really. And the race organizer came in to see me and said, we're so sorry. We thought you could be the first double amputee to do it and all this sort of stuff, which is obviously making me feel loads better. And I was like, look, you know, I'm gutted. And he didn't mean it the way it sounded, but he said, well, I guess that's why no double amputee has ever done this, you know? And I was like, oh, okay. And I was like, all right. I was like, well, do you mind if I come back next year and try again? And he says, no, it's if you want to come back and try again, you know, if you're crazy enough, then sure. I was like, okay. And I honestly don't think he ever thought I would come back. But I came back to the UK. I kind of felt a bit sorry for myself for a little while. And I thought, right, I need to fix all this stuff. There's a list of stuff. I sat on the sofa for about a week and there was a list of things that I could improve on that I'd learned from being out there. And the only thing I couldn't do was make legs that were capable of doing that distance, you know, for being comfortable and capable. Right. It's not like you can go in the garage and turn a lathe on and get going. And I was like, I don't know how to do that. I don't know what to do. And luckily, what had happened was I met this guy, this Italian runner stroke writer for an Italian running magazine. And we swapped details when we're out in Morocco. And when he went back to Italy, he bumped into some friends of his. And they said, ah, Dino, where have you been? What have you been up to? Because he's always up to crazy stuff. And he was like, well, just been out to Morocco and I've been following a racer across the desert. And they're like, okay, standard. And then they were like, Dino's like, what are you guys up to? And he said, ah, well, we've just started up a prosthetics company that make legs and do this and do that. And he was like, that's a bit weird. Because there was a guy out in the desert that was trying to do it with prosthetic legs. And they said, well, did he do it? And they said, no, he didn't do it. And I said, you don't know who he is, do you? I said, yeah. So they got in touch with me and they said, it's so random. They got in touch with me and said, look, do you want to come out to Italy to try these legs? We think we can make you something. And I was like, yeah, this sounds a little bit like, you know, a bit far-fetched really. But then I was like, well, I've got nothing to lose here. You know, for the price of an easy jet flight, why not?
Mm.
So I went out to Italy for a week. And at the end of that week, I came away with these legs that, in all honesty, well, I've still got the same ones now. So, you know, however many years later.
Well, I've seen on YouTube, there is a clip of ITV News in the UK of you going out and being fitted. I recommend everyone to watch this. And it is amazing. They go through the process. And I think what you say is it's like having the most amazing bespoke pair of shoes made for yourself. Because they fit you so perfectly. That, and we're going to talk about the next year of Marathon to Sahara in a minute, but it made all the difference because, you know, what I love about that is obviously you've gone through the heartache of getting so close, but having to decide, not decide to fail, but decide to injure yourself out of the event because you couldn't take another step forward, but not to just go through sheer bloody mindedness, I'm going to do the same again, but look for all those improvements that you could make. That's the real difference, isn't it? You know, that's avoiding the whole, what is it, Einstein said about the definition of insanity being trying to do the same thing and expecting a different result.
Right.
You did it slightly differently. So these legs made all the difference, yeah?
Oh, man. I mean, to the point where you could consistently train, right? So you could say, right, this week I'm going to do 3 long runs. I'm going to do 2 short runs. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And you had no problem. You know, like literally then it's a case of, right, it's whether you want to put the work in. You haven't got that buffer of sort of saying, oh, I can't train, my legs are sore. No, you've got a clear road here. You can get going. Right. And that's the difference. And that was, for me, that was just oh man, it, to have the opportunity to wake up and go, right, I think I'll go and crack a half marathon today. It's brilliant. You know, that is amazing.
So when you, so when you put yourself on the start line for Marathon to Start 2017, what was going through your mind then when you were on the start line that year?
It was 50-50. I was thinking, right, I am fitter, I'm lighter, my kit is like a million times better. I knew exactly what to take, what not to take. My legs are perfect. But then I'm starting to think, yeah, but what if I trip, fall over, break a bone, or what if I do this, or what if I do that? And I had to really work on that psychological side and be like, look, come on, you know, if you can get to one marathon away, you can do this. You know, it's, come on, just need to get on with it. And I had to silence that inner sort of devil on your shoulder saying, yeah, but what if you trip over? What if, you know, and I just had to be like, no, come on, it's fine. And that took a bit of doing. I had like sort of butterflies in my stomach for the first probably 2 days. And I thought, well, my Marathon de Sable doesn't start until I finish that double marathon day, really, because I've got to that point before. So right. I'm just treading water, and I'm not, but it felt like I was treading water to get to that point before I feel like I'm making headway again. And that was quite difficult to swallow. And it was nerve wracking too. And it was exciting. And to even be in that position when a few years before you're in a hospital bed and you're like, oh, you know, I'm in a hospital bed for 5 months and poor me. And suddenly you're waking up in the desert and you're like, ah, I think I'll go and crack 26 miles today.
Yeah.
It's like, it's totally turned on its head.
And were you using that? Were you literally going back in your mind going, that's where I've been, this is where I am, as you say, this is where I'm right now, this is day one again?
Every day.
Yeah.
Every day. I had a mantra every day. And I was like, look, as bad as it gets today, as hot and uncomfortable, and, you know, you might get a bit tired, this is nothing to lying in bed counting roof tiles for 4 months because you've got a broken back. Like, come on, you know. And I give myself that reality check every day, and I was just like, come on, Dunk, like, you've been here before, this is all right, this is not too bad. And also, one of the biggest morale sort of things we had was every night you get emails come around into your tent, and someone had come around with all the printed off emails, and so many people would email me, you know, it gone out on like media that, you know, on the news and stuff that I was doing it, and people would just be like, look, mate, I'm about to lose a leg, and you've given me like a real sort of insight into what can be achieved. And yeah, I don't know, just all these different things. And you just think, how can you fail? You can't fail. And you're raising money and you're pushing the boundaries and you're showing other amputees or other people that are disabled, look, if you want to go and pick something that's hard, you can go and do it. And so it was great, you know. Yeah. It really was great, mate.
So all that support kept you going, the perspective of what you've been through kept you going. Tell me, when you crossed the line, when you finished on that last day, what was that? How did that feel?
Oh, man, crazy. I shed a tear. You know, I'm not too proud to admit that. Yeah, I was just like, I was so amazed that I'd done it. It didn't really sink in. It's just amazing, mate, you know, to be so far out from doing something where not a lot of people believe you can do it, to finally getting across the line and people saying, what up, mate, you've done it, you did it. It's awesome, you know. To think that maybe someone else is watching going, I want to do that just like he did, but maybe better, you know. That's a good and I kind of thought of that, you know. But yeah, it was amazing, mate. Really was.
Well, you know, As I said, this series is all about sporting endeavour, and I can't think of much more incredible endeavour than exactly what you did there in the desert in 2017 and completing that. First ever double amputee to complete the Marathon de Star, but just absolutely amazing, Duncan. Well done.
Oh, thanks, mate. Thanks. And it was, I genuinely mean it, mate. If anyone ever thought of doing stuff like that, don't look around the room and say, I don't think I could do it. Just be like, no, I'm going to go and do it. Just go and do it, because all shapes and sizes, all speeds, all fitnesses can go and do it. And it's hard for everyone, you know. If it's 50 degrees, everyone feels it, you know, it's fine. And it's worth it. It is worth it. Don't say you can't do it. Yeah. It's brilliant. It's phenomenal.
And in that, you say, you know, it's worth it. What did it give you in the years since? What's it given you, do you think, completing that?
I think, it gave me a sort of, a confidence, hopefully, that doesn't stray into arrogance, mate, and like a confidence to sort of sometimes say, I don't mind being the only person in the room that says I can do this, or I think that. And it gave me that little bit of confidence back. You know, there was a lot of people that doubted that I could do that, that a double amputee should even be allowed to go and do it. And I always said, but I wouldn't put in for it if I couldn't do it. And a lot of people just didn't want to listen. So I kind of felt that I proved myself in a sense. And I think that just stays with you. Not that you're always right, definitely not, but more that you are allowed to push your own ideas in life. You know, it's okay. And it's all right to be the one person in the room that's completely different from everyone else. It's all right. And I think that's what it did for me, mate.
Yeah. And have you got, looking forward now, have you got some, because, you know, one of the first words you used was about adventure. It's what I think why you joined the military in the first place. What is the adventure, the challenge that you'd like to take on? I appreciate things that right now are a little bit difficult in COVID times, but when things ease, what is it you want to do?
Well, I think the mountain to climb, mate, is, I don't know whether it'll ever happen, mate, but one thing I've always wanted to do was the Badwater 135.
Right.
Now,
it sounds intense. Just the name sounds intense. Tell us about that.
So it's in America, in the States, in Badwater. And you start off below sea level. It's 135 miles run continuously. So you go from like the lowest point to the highest point. You end up at the Whitney Portal up the side of this sort of mountain. And it's in Deathwater Valley. It's an absolute
Death Valley is like one of the hottest places in the world, isn't it?
Absolute, it's an epic,
right?
But you know, so there's been a single amputee that's done it,
right?
But I'd like to do that. I really would. Right. But getting on a race like that is just like, it's impossible. You know, there's so many people want to get on it, let alone being disabled and getting on it. So I think after COVID, I'd really going to start trying to make some inquiries to try and see if I can just even get an option of going out there, to even just being a support crew for a year, to get a good flavour of it and run sections of it, and then go out and try and actually get on it.
Got it.
That'd be pretty cool, mate.
Well, something tells me, Duncan, with your drive, determination, all those things that are in your mojo mixing bowl that you told us about, you'll find a way. You will find a way. And I really hope you do. And let us know when you do, because I'd love to talk to you. To do it when you've done it. That would be an amazing undertaking.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So, Duncan, thank you so much for joining the Mojo podcast today. It's been truly incredible to hear your story. So inspiring. And thanks for sharing that with us.
Mate, thanks for the time. And thanks for being interested, mate. Cheers. Thank you.
What a fantastic guy. I really enjoyed our conversation, and really that could have been several hours long, but I have a feeling I'll be getting Duncan back on the podcast in the future, maybe to talk about his adventures in the South Pole with Prince Harry, and certainly to talk about his future challenges and endeavours. So many really powerful takeouts there again to apply to your life as you choose to. Here's a few that jump out for me. I really like the thinking around taking the little wins, which Duncan refers to frequently. Certainly a positive tactic of his to cope with the stuff that's coming up for him and to find resilience, be that during COVID-19, going through and getting the most from his rehab and each step of a grueling foot race through the desert. And his healthy avoidance of comparison, again, the life he needs to live during lockdown, doing what is right for him and his family, versus obsessing over what others might be doing. And that also goes for his challenges, I think. Doing what is right for him versus chasing a record for the sake of the record. And how his mojo is linked to the well-being of others I found fascinating too. Again, family and others close to him. The older military veteran he befriended, for example. And the troops he used to, not so much command, I feel, but look after. If you're going to commit to a massive endurance challenge with anyone, Duncan would be a great partner, I'd say. And on that, if anyone listening has any kind of links to the Badwater 135 in the US, please do get in touch to help Duncan get involved or get a place when that race opens up again. He's definitely really focused on completing that. Okay, I've been talking to more incredible people with amazing mojo stories over the last few weeks. Can't wait to bring those episodes to you every 2 weeks. Remember to subscribe to get notifications. Please do leave that 5-star rating. And if you can find some time, please do write a short review on Apple Podcasts. It really, really helps more people discover the Mojo Podcast. Until next time, I hope your mojo continues to flow.